he received the fatal blow. It was at this point that Shemr, whose mother was a disbeliever, came forward and severed the imam's noble head from the body. The noble head kissed often by Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Shemr and others had the audacity to carry it on a lane to Yazid in Damascus, almost 1,000 kilometers away. The tragedy did not end as Ibn Sa'd ordered the horsemen to trample upon the bodies of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and the other martyred members of the Bani Hashim clan. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, thus fulfilled the divine promise of the great sacrifice, or Zebhen Azim, as mentioned in Ayah 107 of Surah Safat of the Noble Quran, that had ransomed Prophet Ishmael in antiquity, though temporarily substituted by a ram, in order to spare the aged Prophet Abraham of such a ghastly sight. Umar ibn Sa'd and his Umayyad forces took the women and children as prisoners in shackles, put them on camels, and proceeded from Karbala to Kufa and from then to Damascus in Syria. At the forefront of the procession were the heads of the noble martyrs mounted on lances. Karbala is the cruelest tragedy humanity has ever seen, yet the startling, though appalling, events in Karbala proved like a powerful volcano that shook the very foundation of Muslims. It stirred them consciousness, ignorant or learned alike. For sincere Muslims, Karbala turned into a triumph. The tragic event became the very beacon of light to always remind Muslims to practice Islam honestly and sincerely, to do what is right irrespective of consequences, and fear no one except Allah. The events of Karbala reflect the collision of the good versus the evil, the virtuous versus the wicked. Imam Hussein, as the third legitimate successor of his grandfather, the Prophet, thus safeguarded and protected Islam, thereby becoming the best of guide for Muslims. No wonder the Prophet had remarked, "Indeed, Hussein, peace upon him, is the beacon of light and the ark of salvation." The tragedy of Karbala thus taught humanity a lesson that standing for the truth and fighting unto death, for it is more honorable and valuable than submitting to the wrongful, especially when the survival of Islam is at stake. We'll be right back.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم قال ألم نربك فينا وليدا ولبثت فينا من عمرك سنين.
Pharaoh said, did we not raise you among us as a child, and you remained among us for years of your life?
وفعلت فعلتك التي فعلت وأنت من الكافرين.
And then you did your deed which you did, and you were of the ungrateful.
قال فعلتها إذا وأنا من الضالين.
Moses said, I did it then, while I was of those astray.
ففررت منكم لما خفتكم فوهب لي ربي حكما وجعلني من المرسلين.
So I fled from you when I feared you. Then my Lord granted me wisdom and prophethood and appointed me as one of the messengers.
وتلك نعمة تمنها علي أن عبدت بني إسرائيل.
And is this a favor of which you remind me, that you have enslaved the children of Israel?
Brothers and sisters, previously we were discussing the 22nd verse of chapter Shu'ara. وَتِلْكَ نِعْمَةٌ تَمُنُّهَا عَلَيْهِ أَنْ عَبَّدْتَ بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلِ. And is it a favor with which you reproach me that you have enslaved the children of Israel? Here is what Moses is answering Pharaoh, beginning with the 20th verse, that he said, فَعَلْتُهَا إِذَنْ وَأَنَا مِنَ الضَّالِّينَ فَفَرَرْتُ مِنْكُمْ لَمَّا خِفْتُكُمْ فَوَهَبَ لِي رَبِّي حُكْمًا وَجَعَلَنِي مِنَ الْمُرْسَلِينَ. So I fled from you because I feared you, and then it was the time that my Lord granted me wisdom and made me one of the messengers. And here is what Moses answers Pharaoh regarding that question. Pharaoh asked him, that did we not cherish you as a child among us? You tarried among us for many years, and here is what you have for us instead. Instead of all these blessings, you come to us, you kill one of us, and you want to invite us to monotheism? You want to deny the fact that I am your great Lord, أَنَا رَبُّكُمُ الْأَعْلَى. You negate this. But Moses decisively says, تِلْكَ نِعْمَةٌ تَمُنُّهَا عَلَيْهِ أَنْ أَبَّتَ بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلِ. What we concluded, and let us emphasize on that once more in the previous episode, is that there are two possible meanings for this part of this chapter, for this verse. The first is that this is not a blessing. تِلْكَ نِعْمَةٌ تَمُنُّهَا عَلَيْهِ This question is a kind of negating question. This is not a blessing because you are the first reason that I was sent on the wooden in a wooden box in the Nile River by my mother. She wanted to protect me, and that, of course, by the hands of events, I was brought up to your palace, but I was unwillingly brought up in this place. And why was I deprived of my mother's place? The other possible commentary is that the purpose of Moses is that it is a blessing, but this blessing, in comparison with all the oppressions and crimes you made beside it, is nothing. In this program, we want to add another commentary. The third commentary that can be mentioned for the answer of Moses to Pharaoh is that if Moses ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhim as-salam was brought up in Pharaoh's palace and enjoyed various blessings, it must not be forgotten that the real builders of that palace were the slaves taken from the nation of Moses, and the producers of those buildings were the prisoners of the children of Israel. So, from any kind of aspect you look at this kind of blessing, this cannot be called ni'mah. This is not a blessing. This is not a favor. And all these answers, all these possible explanations, translations, and commentaries seem to be right. The question is, how did Pharaoh reproach Moses for enjoying his own nation products? على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter. تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, dear listeners, as you were with us, we mentioned three different commentaries about this answer Moses gives Pharaoh. And these three commentaries, these mentioned commentaries, are not inconsistent with each other. And as was mentioned, they all seem to be negating the fact that this is not a ni'mah, this is not a favor. But of course, for me, the first one seems to be clearer from some aspects. The last part of the verse we're going to discuss is the word min al-mursaleen. وَجَعَلَنِي مِنَ الْمُرْسَلِينَ And he set me from among the messengers. This Quranic phrase is referring to the fact that Moses was not the only messenger of Allah, and before him, there had come many prophets, and Moses was only one of the divine prophets. And Pharaoh did forget all these things. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then send our condolences to our 12th and living Imam, Al-Hujja, Ajjalallahu Ta'ala, Farajahu Sharif, and to each and every one of you, as we gather on this evening and on these nights to commemorate the tragedy that befell upon the household of Rasulullah, Sallallahu Alaihi Wa Alihi Wasallam. You know, when we gather for the last 10 nights, and we do the masayib every night of companions, we do the masayib every night of family. Sometimes we have to put it into perspective that it all happened on one day. It was all had to be endured in one day. We have time to deal with it. There was no time for the Imam to deal with it. The Imam had to be in it. There came a time when Imam was all alone. He called out, "Hal min dabin yadubu an harami Rasulillah?" Is there anyone to come and defend the family of Rasulullah? "Hal min muwahidin yakhafu Allahu fina?" Is there not anyone who believes in Allah that will come to our defense? "Hal min mughithin yarju Allah bi ghathatina?" Is there not any rescuer that will come and rescue us? When the shouts and the cries of the Imam alayhi salam were heard, it is said in Maqtal al-Husayn that at this time one man came out. One man, Sajjad, comes out of his tent. Umme Kulthum says, "Beta, come back. My son, come back. You are in no condition." Sajjad was so weak, the narration says, that he could not even hold a sword. But he says, "My Imam has called me." "My Imam has called me. How can I not answer the call of my Imam?" Hussein says, "O Umme Kulthum, take Sajjad back. For if we lose him, there will be no successor to the heir of Rasulullah." And then the Imam goes towards the Khaymah. Why? To bid farewell to the ladies and children. You know, it is this gham of the widas that breaks my heart every time. What must Zainab be thinking at this time? She knows that every time someone comes for wida, they don't come back. What does Sakina think at this time? That this is my baba, he's going now. And my chacha left, he never came back. My brothers left, they never came back. Imam comes into his khaymah, his tent, and he asks for his oldest clothes. And then he is given his oldest clothes. And then he makes holes in these clothes. We say, "What do you plan on doing, Yabna Rasulullah?" The Imam knows that these enemies, these mal'uneen, will not leave his body alone afterwards. So in hopes that he wears these old garments, maybe they will leave him covered. But Yabna Rasulullah, they did not. Yabna Rasulullah, they had no shame in what they did. The Imam alayhi salam then goes into the tent of Sajjad to bid him farewell. The narration says that the Imam bequeathed him, left him his wasiya. But I tell you, my heart asks me, my mind asks me, that when Sajjad looks at his father, he sees him bloodied. He sees him alone. He sees the thirst on his lips. I wonder if Sajjad asked, "Baba, where is my uncle Abba? Oh, my uncle, where is my brother Ali ibn al-Akbar? Where is my brother Qasim? Why are you in this state?" But alas, the Imam alayhi salam is alone. And then the Imam comes out after having bid farewell to Sajjad. He comes out on the tents of the family. In Abbas al-Qummi, Sheikh Abbas al-Qummi says, he cries out, "O Sakina, O Fatima, O Zainab, O Umme Kulthum, alaykunna minni salam. Upon you is my final salam." It is mentioned in Al-Manaqib that at that point, Sakina rushes out to Imam al-Husayn. She hugs Imam al-Husayn. Imam al-Husayn hugs her towards his chest, and then he recites some poetry. He says, "Sayatulu ba'di ya sukaynatu fa'lami min kilbuka'u iza al-himamu dahani." He says, "Sakina, after me, they will make you cry for a long time, Sakina. But oh, Sakina, have mercy on your father. Do not cry while he is still alive, for your cries break the heart of your father. Sakina and Imam embrace one another. The Imam alayhi salam now begins to get onto his horse, but he hears a familiar voice from behind. It is said that the voice was that of Zainab saying, Mahlan ya akhi, wait one moment, oh my brother. يوقف حتى أزود من نظري. Let me look at you one more time, O Hussein. Because the next time I see you, your head will be removed from your body. The next time I see you, your body will be trampled. Let me look at you one more time, O Hussein. Once the Imam decides to go, it is his turn. The narrators mentioned that we were surprised at the way Hussein was attacking. This was a man who was thirsty. This was a man since morning had been going to the battlefield and back. He had been bruised and hurt. Yet Hussein attacked like a raging lion. Anyone that would come in front of him, Hussein would send him to Jahannam. Anytime someone would dare come in front, Imam would handle that. Umar ibn Sa'ad knew that this was no way to finish Hussein. He called out 4,000 people to come and shoot arrows at Abu Abdullah. Arrows began to rain down upon the Imam alayhi salam. It is said in Maqtal, some struck his chest, some struck his throat. Imam al-Hussein kept resisting, kept fighting. At one point, it is said he saw Shimr Mal'un with his companions about to attack the tent of Hussein. Imam calls out to Umar ibn Sa'ad, "Hey Umar! Have some shame. Hussein is still alive. If you do not fear Allah, then be free men in this world." They retreat back. And now Imam al-Hussein continues, but there comes a point when Hussein is exhausted. It is that Imam stops on his horse. And his Imam is paused. It is said a mal'oon took a rock and threw the rock at the forehead of Imam. It said it hit the Imam with such force that blood began to fall on the face of the Imam. This is that same forehead Rasulullah used to kiss. This is that same forehead Ali and Fatima used to kiss. Blood began to trickle down the face, spill down on the face of Hussein. The narration says Hussein took his abba, took his shirt and raised it to wipe the blood from his face. At that time, an arrow with poison hit the chest of Hussein alayhi salam falls to the ground. The details are heartbreaking. There comes a man who stabs him with a spear on his collar. He removes that spear, stabs Hussein on the chest. Imam falls to the ground. Imam is laid on the ground. At this time, the mal'oon Shimr calls out, "What are you waiting for? Finish Hussein." But no one came forward except for Shimr. My brothers and sisters, I do not have the strength to tell you what happens next, but Sahib al-Zaman tells us in Ziyaratun Nahiya, "Wal Shimru jalisun ala sadrik."
اللهم اجعل محياي محيا محمد وآل محمد ومماتي ممات محمد وآل محمد.
Forever
in our hearts and in
swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
The Uber files has been released, and it looks more like a rap sheet than anything else, from tax dodging to lobbying diplomats and foreign dignitaries to price manipulation. And from what we did at this Economic Divide program, this may involve dodgy financial accounting reporting. Hi, I'm Kavit Hathaway. Welcome to Economic Divide. Today's program is about the Uber files. Some of the topics that we'll be covering in today's program: the Uber leaks. It was reported that they broke laws, they duped police, and they exploited violence against drivers. Just some of the things that the Uber leaks revealed. Another highlight of the program, the strategy behind Uber. It undercut tax-free markets. It lobbied for new laws in order to protect them. And it also paved the way for the Uber application to be installed with the general masses. Of course, that produced controversies within itself. And finally, Uber friends, politicians and barons, they acted against their own citizens. That is the cost of being friends with Uber.
Uber is a tech giant that provides mobility services globally. It allows users to book a car and a driver for transportation. Its services also include food delivery, package delivery, couriers, and freight transportation. The company is based in San Francisco, with operations in approximately 72 countries and 10,500 cities. Over the years, it has come to be known as a reliable service, with 118 million monthly active users worldwide. With 19 million trips per day, it generated over $17.4 billion in revenues in 2021. But Uber's success is not only due to the creativity and ingenuity of its founders.
In short, digital platforms have massive potential. They offer working flexibility, they create jobs, bring innovation, and cater for what is clearly a strong consumer demand. However, people are the heart are at the heart of this business model. They deserve the same protection and conditions as any other worker in any EU country, including access to collective bargaining and representation.
Uber technology, as it is called, is known to be a ride-sharing application, among other things. But the funny thing about this company is that there's more negative material out there than positive information on it. Then came the Uber files, and boom, that just pushed the controversies over the top. These are some of the things that people have said online about the company. First, to rig the marketplace so a company with $20 billion in financing but no actual competitive advantages could destroy operators who were willing to obey existing laws but had much less financing. Our next tweet comes from Chile, or on Chile, which says, following Italy trying to bring down the government, taxi drivers protest against Uber licenses and the price of fuel. The Uber files prove that WEF connections allowed them to fund trading at a loss to force small businesses out of business. Well, talk about Italians. They are saying no to human beings' modern slavery, as it's been described, which is an oppression to drivers by Uber. And finally, we needed to take a look at the Uber files itself in terms of how it was described by the whistleblower who came forward, where it said, as a title, "We sold people a lie."
My name is Mark McGann. I'm a former senior executive at Uber, and I'm here as a whistleblower. I'm the one who revealed what's become known as the Uber files. I'd worked in highly stressful environments before. Uber was very different. It was very intense. Threats, violence, death threats on social media. And it's only when you come off that kind of hamster wheel and you take a step back that you realize how crazy it all was.
Ouch, that's gotta hurt. That's how this has been described. Let's introduce our guests, though, and see what they think. Sergio Avedian is a senior contributor at the Rideshare Guy who joins us. Sergio Avedian, welcome. Looking at this ride-sharing application by the name of Uber, it has its enemies not only within the U.S. but outside the U.S. The expansion that took place across the world was rather phenomenal, where hundreds of leaders in dozens of countries were courted. It included, obviously, politicians. But didn't the politicians act with regards to Uber in a way that it sacrificed their own citizens?
It obviously did, right? So all the existing cab companies, let's say, because when Uber first showed up, they showed up as a disruptor. Disruptor meaning they wanted to revolutionize public and personal transportation, which they have done. In some cases, obviously, not that the documents show, illegally, and in some cases, risking the lives of their own drivers. Well, we know what happened as far as in Europe is concerned, as well as the United States, that cab companies were not happy about this because Uber, is not a regulated company. While cab industry in all over the world is regulated industry by the local and state authorities.
All right, let's bring in Professor Joe Haslam and see what he thinks. We welcome him, Executive Director of the Owners Scale Up Program at IE Business School in Madrid, Spain. Professor Joe Haslam, welcome to Economic Divide. Uber followed some unscrupulous business ethics, to say the least, in which taxi and cab markets were put under pressure. Governments were pushed to rewrite laws, and also we're looking at an app-based gig economy model of work that has since proliferated across the world. What is there to say that this is not going to happen in other industries within those countries who are, in essence, harming its workers?
Yeah, it's a great question. But the issue is, of course, is that the fun will continue until the money runs out. And a lot of these gig economy companies, these apps, super apps, whatever you want to call them, have been funded by venture capital. The idea that you invest for growth instead of profit and that you drive out all competitions and then raise prices. However, we're now at a period at the end of cheap money where it's not going to be possible anymore to fund these companies indefinitely. So I think there would have been a problem if we weren't at the end of cheap money, but I think the situation will sort itself out.
But the fact that Uber's IPO was not the success story that it should have been isn't really about the fundamentals of the company today. It's more about the fact that their valuation got too high too fast in the past, and that severely constrained their ability to set a fair price for their value for their IPO when they went public.
It's time now for the info news section of the program. Our first item surely will catch your attention, and it is about something that actually relates to the Ukraine conflict. It's called deglobalization. That's right. World economy at risk of deglobalization based on what the IMF has said. Now, Russia's military operation in Ukraine and Western sanctions on Moscow, well, they might push the global economy into geopolitical fragmentation. That's kind of a dark side scenario that is another consequence of the Ukraine conflict. Next up, Kenya. Kenya's economy is our focus in this particular post that we brought out for you. Debt shadow clouds Kenya's forthcoming presidential polls. So obviously, as usual, the economy is what drives a poll or an election in this case. Kenya's economy at this point is Africa's sixth biggest, but its debt is up to two-thirds of the GDP. So debt plaguing Kenya is obviously a big burden on the economy there, not to mention other countries in Africa. Our next post is very dangerous in terms of the unity of Europe as a whole. That is our focus, where Europe's fight to stay united over the war in Ukraine, that's actually is being put to the test. That has been going on for some time. Now, Europe as a whole is now forced to wrestle with soaring inflation. We know that. The bloc is not as united as it seems. And we are seeing, obviously, the gas stoppage from Russia, which has amounted to quite a bit, especially for a country like Germany, to break this unity at this point, which seems to be inevitable in some senses. Next up, we go to the United States, a pact by the name of Schumer and Manchin. It's a tax and spending deal that they call the Inflation Reduction Act, in which new taxes and price controls to pay for green corporate welfare for the politically favored is the focus. Now, the question that many are asking is their aim to reduce inflation by chilling business investments and the economy? So obviously there's hidden factors that others are seeing in this pact between the two. Those were the ones that we picked in terms of news for you with the flavor of the economy in it. Of course, we would appreciate it if you... Hello and welcome to our in-depth section. Uber as a company has been filled with controversies, no doubt about that. Now, aside from these controversies, in this in-depth section, we actually wanted to find out if Uber was profitable or not. I mean, that's a simple approach here, but yet a very important one. In other words, was it making money or was it still incurring losses? Well, we found out even that is a challenge in itself. For example, in the year 2019, this is what the company actually reported. The headline read, how can a company lose $5.2 billion in revenues of $3.2 billion? Uber is going to show you how. $5.2 billion in revenues, $3.2 billion is what actually came out of that in terms of losses. Now, that is the question that comes to mind. How can the company actually lose $5.2 billion when the revenues were only $3.2 billion? Now, breaking that down is actually very hard, and digesting it is actually harder, but here is what the profit and loss comes into view for the operation of Uber. We went back all the way to the year 2014 and then went all the way to the year 2019. The ones in the blue are the profits. The ones in the red are the losses. The thing is, Uber reported sales of only $3.2 billion. In other words, the net loss actually exceeded, again, sales by $2 billion. The loss of $5.24 billion added to the loss of $878 million in the first quarter. So overall, Uber lost $6.25 billion in the first half of 2019. Total revenue for the two quarters was $6.3 billion. All right, next up, let's fast forward to November 2021. Another shocking headlines, in this case in point, we're going to tell you what that means. Uber reports a loss, even as revenue jumped 72%, $5.9 billion losses, from three of their other operations that they just splashed money onto, Diddy Global, Grab Holdings, and Aurora. Again, $5.2 billion in losses. The revenues jumped, according to them, 72%. But thanks to its $3.2 billion loss in those three ventures, that was called the write-down. The amount, again, $5.2 billion. It said that this loss was due to unrealized losses from these stakes that I just mentioned. So there you have another headline where the numbers just don't add up in terms of the conclusion that is being reached. Now, we then proceeded actually to look at the figures from the actual books at Uber in terms of its profit and loss statements. Well, this is what we found out. Uber's fourth quarter and full year results for the year 2021, very recent, gross bookings at $25.9 billion. That's up 72% year over year. Net income recorded $892 million, which is almost $1 billion. That's the actual figures that is the most current that we had based on what Uber actually reported, which projected a gross bookings of, as we mentioned, $25.9 billion with a net income of $892 million. Now, let's move on to the company CEO, Mr. Khosrow Shahi. That's right, he's Iranian origin. He has said that Uber's driver base is, from what he has said, at a post-pandemic high to explain some of the high figures or the profitability projection. And he said that it expects engagement to continue without significant incremental incentive investments. He has to say that. See, people have to realize that because he has to show that there's momentum in the money that Uber is making. And also, at the same time, explain the loss, but that it's moving forward in terms of the money that the company is actually making. If you didn't understand that, that's okay. Let me bring in Sergio Avedin. He's the senior contributor who rejoins us, the rideshare guy. All right, Sergio Avedian, welcome back to Economic Divide. We are looking at this leaked trove of confidential files. Lots of revelations there. It flouted the laws. It duped police. Things that you're very much familiar with. At this point, why was there such a drive then behind Uber to go to these lengths to offer a service which sounds like it shouldn't be so intricate when it comes to a ride-sharing application? What are your thoughts on that?
Thanks for having me on. I'm from the first day, actually, all the way to today, Uber doesn't call itself a rideshare company to start with. That's just a word that just came around. They call themselves a technology company. So the reason for that is because they have been breaking the local city and state and federal laws, labor laws, transportation laws from their inception. So to me, you know, this is not that much of a surprise. These documents have been floating around for a while. I've known about these documents for a while. You know, look, they have to do what they have to do. You know, they went to lengths of breaking laws, obviously, and lobbying efforts. And as we know, in politics today, lobbying is in every issue is very strong. I'm not condoning what they did, but they were also trying to protect close to 50, 60, at some point, $100 billion worth of market capitalization.
All right, thank you very much, Sergio Avedian. Perhaps he gave us a bit of a background behind the numbers that we just covered. All right, let's bring back Mr. Joe Haslam, Executive Director at Owner Scale Up Program, who rejoins us from Madrid, Spain. Welcome back, Joe Haslam. We're trying to find out an explanation behind the numbers that Uber has offered, behind the way that the company has acted in terms of not only its operations, but also in terms of the aggressive global expansion that it has gone through. How do you explain the way that Uber has acted, and why has it gone through such lengths to offer what appears to be a ride-sharing application?
No, a lot of this comes down to the Silicon Valley philosophy of rugged individualism, much of which comes from Andrew Ryan, who's a philosopher who wrote books like The Fountainhead. They kind of believe that existing structures hold back progress. I mean, if you talk to Silicon Valley, the cliche is often, you know, we're changing the world, we're making the world a better place. And it isn't until after they've left these companies that they start to see the destruction they've left. So while in the beginning, everyone sort of talks to the people, talks to the authorities, very quickly they get frustrated and they change their approach, which is just, let's just launch and see what happens. I mean, Facebook called this move fast and break things, but it's the same philosophy that applies in Uber. So they have a playbook whereby they go to a city and then they just start launching the application. And then they hope that they can get enough support from the public that the politicians then won't shut down the service.
Massive corruption involving Uber and its dirty practices have now emerged that show the company's success was not really down to standard business practices. The case, which has come to be known as the Uber Files and involves more than 124,000 company files, has shed light on the unscrupulous methods used by the company. The files, which are from the period 2013 to 2017, include correspondence, emails, company presentations, and text messages to elected officials.
One of the officials who was secretly consulted by Uber for illegal business advantages was Emmanuel Macron, the then economy minister of France in the government of former President François Hollande. Uber cut a secret deal with Macron to help the company get away with tight regulations of the sector, seen with the current CEO of Uber, Dara Khosrowshahi. So what were those secrets? This is what Ramin Mazohiri, our correspondent in Paris, said.
Macron apparently held secret meetings which resulted in secret deals that undermined laws created to regulate Uber, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the National Labor Code.
Let's break down what Uber is actually guilty of here. The secret deals that involved Macron and Uber were as follows. The goal, to undermine laws created to regulate Uber safety, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the National Labor Code. Macron also helped Uber consolidate its position in France. The company also approached other top politicians, including then U.S. Vice President Joe Biden and George Osborne, the U.K.'s former Chancellor of Exchequer. Apart from cutting secret deals with politicians, Uber is also accused of jeopardizing the livelihoods of many people. In some cities, Uber initially paid nearly 90% of drivers' hourly earnings in order to drive out competitors. That was essentially giving rides for free, which sent taxi drivers into economic despair. And finally, the controversy which drew the most attention from the drivers was the issue of employment status. Rideshare services Uber and Lyft defended their business model, fighting a law requiring them to reclassify their drivers as employees. The law requires businesses in the gig economy to reclassify independent contractors as employees eligible for unemployment coverage, medical, and other benefits, something both Lyft and another ride-sharing app and Uber have categorically refused to do. Here's one demo that took place in front of the Uber headquarters in San Francisco back in 2020.
All these companies, they're paying under a minimum wage. Protections that people fought for generations prior to this are getting tossed out the window under the language of freelance or flexibility. But if you can't pay someone minimum wage to do their job, you shouldn't have a company.
Why I'm saying no to 22 is because it doesn't do enough. It's really a facade by the companies to try to maintain their profits, to stay in the black instead of the red, and that comes at our expense.
The Uber Files is an example of how cheap money funneled in an extravagant IPO flooded the company with cash, which was unable to venture out into other arenas. Now, whether those other arenas were successful or not, that's a whole other story. However, in the process, politicians were courted and they were lobbied in order to make way for this business. Surprised? You shouldn't be. This is what's called capitalism at its best. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. From Mikko Vetäpä and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to I'm Atar, the host of this program. Please accept our condolences on behalf of me, Mr. Mahmoud, the producer of the program Viewpoints, and all the staff of Call of Islam Radio. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Muhammad Khani and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
We're welcome to the show. And Sheikh Muhammad Khani, assalamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. It's an honor to be here.
So for today's discussion, we want to discuss one of the rituals which is done usually in the morning processions or the ceremonies done in the month of Muharram by some minorities of the Shias all around the world. And that is the ritual of tatbir. In Arabic, they say Qamazani in Farsi or Turkish, because Qama is a Turkish word, and so roughly translated into English as self-flagellation. Mm. You know, just using a piece of knife or a dagger on the forehead, especially to blood, in remembrance of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy that was done on the 61 AH according to the Hijra calendar. So the passionate aspect of the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam finds a place in here. Especially when you look at the people who are doing this tatbih thing, the young generation, okay, who are passionate and in this, for example, this sure chest beating, okay, or latam, they are doing this with this passionate thing. So maybe, I don't know, maybe some of the scholars have thought that, okay, in order to attract the young generation, this would be a nice
There were many reasons, because the scholars, the Shias, were oppressed in Iraq at that time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We can see that, how they were oppressed by the rulers in the Iraq all the time. So it was a kind of, terrifying reaction.
Yeah. Okay.
And through this, people were coming to their religion.
Uh-huh.
Within the territory of Iraq, when the media was not this way, the way we can see now.
Okay.
But today, when we see this media, you can see all the maraji, all the jurists have the fatwa. If it causes vahan, if it causes the you know, one is, you know, weakening the religion.
Yes, yes.
If people think about your religion
defaming
as
religion.
Something, you know,
defaming, people despising the religion. Yes.
With the Daesh and all those, obviously, these okay. are definitely, you know, the things that are defaming the religion. So if it is the reason, then it is haram. So one of the things is this. Obviously, they're not clearly saying that because of some reasons. Maybe there are different reasons behind it. If they're not clearly saying, those who are not saying it.
That's right.
But obviously, they are giving the same fatwa. Mm-hmm. That if anything that marks on your body permanently and it results in a defect in your body.
Yes, injury.
The second thing is, if it is the cause of wahan of the religion, then obviously it is haram. This is how they are basically saying it. Obviously, gradually, with the passage of time, we might see like all the maraji will give the fatwa of haram because it does not have more than 200 years history.
Yes.
What I was saying, like in the Orthodox, obviously we see that because they have a ideology of the Jesus Christ to be, you know,
sacrificed for our sins.
So basically, they have this ideology, and they have this in the religion.
Right.
Might be 200 years ago, some Christians who became Muslim, when they heard about Imam Hussein's history, they started to do this. Because in India, Indo-Pak, like India and Pakistan, we have many rituals, many customs that have been taken from the Hindu religion and they have brought to the Shia religion.
That's right.
When these Hindus become Muslim and Shia. So there are many customs,
the rituals
that
customs
are similar between the Hindus and the Shias when they perform. The Shias are performing on the month of like Muharram. For example, you know, Hindus, they have their own statues and you know, the big statues which they take and they have this kind of procession.
Yes.
On the day of Muharram, you can see on the internet. There are many places in Pakistan where the Shias, even in the India, where they make this Taziana, for example. So this is a kind of, you know, similar to what they used to do. But now it has a religious Islamic name on it. It has the name of Imam Hussein. And they say, like, we are making. There is no sense of such big, you know, Taziana, what they make.
That's right.
It does not give you any remembrance of Karbala. But the only thing is, historically, it's been, you know, it's been raised for 700 years or maybe 400 years or 300 years. So we have these customs. The main issue is that whenever you leave Karbala as a combat and you take it as a custom, then obviously it is a religion of custom. It is this. It is something to practice as a custom.
That's right. Two great oppositions to tatbir were done by two of the outstanding ulama, one of whom was the fatwa that was given by Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Aswahani. It said that in istimal al-suyuf wa-salasal wa-tubul wa-al-awwaq وما يجري اليوم في مواكب العذاب يوم عاشوراء انما هو محرم وهو غير شرعي. This is the exact phrase of the fatwa of Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Aswani, that using, for example, the
blade,
swords,
knife, sword,
drums, and the swords and the drums, you know.
Blood spilling, basically.
The horns and something like that are forbidden. Also, Sayyid Muhsin al-Amin, with writing a very great book, At-Tanzih lil-A'mal al-Shabih, you know, he was trying to correct the mourning processions of Imam al-Hussein al-Islam with criticizing all these rituals. And some of the scholars have said that maybe such rituals deviate the minds of the people from the true message of Imam al-Hussein al-Islam.
Yeah, that could be argued as well. It can, especially in our time where when you look at how the mourning processions are being perceived, especially in the Western world, you'll find, for example, you just have to Google it. As soon as you Google Ashura, instead of seeing pictures and posters where it's justice against injustice, you know, like establishing true Islamic teachings, all about true Islamic teachings. I remember it from my own school time back when I used to study in Denmark. When you opened the book, the first chapter, when you came to Shia Islam, the first chapter was a picture of a lot of Muslims that were walking in the streets with blood everywhere. So basically, I would say that's definitely defaming the religion. There's no doubt about that.
Yes.
Because any person who sees that scene or that picture would be disgusted by it.